you just heard Love Junkie by Toshiki Kadomatsu, and before that, Kesenai Omoi by Yumi Tanimura. And that title actually meant The Memory That I Cannot Forget. Quite a fitting title for a song like that. That was a lot of good tracks for tonight, but I'm afraid we don't have time to rest, because coming up, we have another stellar track. This one's by Seiya Matsumoto, Konya mo Hi-Fi. But this one's different. This one came out rather recently, from 2018, from the album appropriately named City Lights.
醒的灵魂啊，快拉上你的窗帘，生活像太软的床垫，翻来覆去都不对，就算躲家里面外事也未必 OK。 不管你白天的那张笑脸有多疲倦，他在大哭之前别忘记拉上窗帘，心头盼盼盼，像小偷飞檐攀墙，四处转转转，对着你虎视眈眈，眼睛弹弹弹，当你浑身不自在，世界乱了乱了。
WHCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, from American songs to Japanese songs, from Korean songs to Chinese songs, we play all of them. And in case you haven't noticed, that last song, the song that you're hearing right now, was by Pauline Lan, and this song is called Telescope. This one was from Taiwan, it's a song in Chinese. And before that, I Feel Love by Yukika. Yukika is a Korean singer, but she sung in Japanese to replicate a city pop feel. And before that, Kaoru Kurosawa with Windy Love. Up next, we're going to have a track called The Tokyo Taste, and it was covered by Hamasaki Yoko. The original version was released in the 70s, and it was an absolute pinnacle in city pop history. Let's listen to it.
さという名のしこりがいつかなくなる日が来ると信じて信じて信じて気持ちも溶かしてこのままずっと眠りたい何も見えない逃げ回る背を追うのに夢中今日も明日も明後日も眠れぬ夜は空を見上げて散らばる思いを奏でるメロディーその目の奥に映るものは何光る糸を距離も不意に近い
That was the track Who Are You by a rather obscure Japanese female duo called Girls B. I have no idea why they chose that name, but honestly, it really made them very hard to search on Google. And it really did take me a couple of months to find the right listing for the CD. But, you know, in the end, it was all worth it, I'm telling you. All because of that track, this track that you're hearing right now. So smooth and so funky. Before that, Uni Style with It's Love. And before that, Eiichiro Taruki with Candy Soul. Coming up next, we're going to have a track by one of yours truly's favorite Japanese groups of all time. The track is called the Mabushi Photograph or Dazzling Photograph, and the group's name is Platinum 900.
Thank you.
wasn't that absolutely beautiful? The strings, the organ, the melody, they just all work in perfect balance. They work together and they create a masterpiece of a song, honestly. Well, unfortunately, it is time for me to go again. I hope you enjoyed the past hour with me here on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I sincerely hope you have a good rest of our weekend as well as the start of your next week. And I sincerely also hope you enjoy the ending theme to this week's City Pop Central. It is a very special song. It is Siren no Uta, or The Song of the Siren by the Japanese group Killinji, which is also one of my favorite Japanese bands of all time. So yeah, well, see you next week. Until then, good night.
worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
4 years ago, Texas experienced its worst blackout in state history. But there's one factor that never got much attention.
Natural gas failed in a big way.
The gas system that feeds many power plants simply didn't work. But why?
There's no plausible explanation for it other than a manipulation of price and a manipulation of supply.
Season 3 of The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout is out now. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My family had the most effect on my becoming a journalist. I came from a family of serious-minded scholars. I have five brothers and sisters, all of whom are holders of advanced degrees in one field or another. One of my brothers is a holder of two earned PhD degrees. So as you can see, ours is a family heavily oriented toward education and service. I grew up wanting most of all to write and spent most of my childhood experimenting with writing. And concluded that it was the world for me. I saw so much that I thought needed to be described, communicated, explored, explained, and so forth. So that just became my outlet.
The late Robert C. Maynard, journalist, newspaper publisher, editor, and former owner of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard was a charismatic leader who changed the face of American journalism and built a four-decade career on the cornerstone of editorial integrity, community involvement, improved education, and the importance of the family. He was also co-founder of the Institute for Journalism Education, a nonprofit corporation dedicated to expanding opportunities for minority journalists at the nation's newspapers. In the 1980s, Maynard began a twice-weekly syndicated newspaper column in which he transformed national and international issues into dinner table discussions of right and wrong. When he bought the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. But Maynard had a career full of firsts, from being the first African-American national newspaper correspondent to being the first African-American newspaper editor-in-chief. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Life and Legacy of Robert C. Maynard in Black America.
Before I go on to say how that particular movement affected me personally, I want to say something about our profession that I think is an indictment of sorts. You know, we still have a ways to go toward full equality for blacks in America. But I think it's unfortunate that our media has not made it clear to the American people that what happened between 1950 and 1980, let's say, in America, 30 years, is probably one of the most phenomenal revolutions that's occurred in human history. To take the condition that blacks were in those days and to see the number of barriers that fell and the number of conditions that changed and the number of opportunities that present themselves today versus in that day. And it's a remarkable march. And black Americans should take greater pride in what we have already accomplished. That does not mean we should slacken in what we feel we need to continue to accomplish. But we should not allow ourselves, or deny ourselves, I should say. We shouldn't deny ourselves a justly deserved compliment.
The late Robert C. Maynard was a dynamic leader in American journalism throughout the 1970s and 1980s. He was the first African-American to own a major metropolitan daily newspaper. Maynard was the publisher of a struggling Oakland Tribune from 1983 until 1992. Through that newspaper and the Institute for Journalism Education, which he co-founded in 1976, he became instrumental in training and placing minority journalists in important positions nationwide. Born on June 17, 1937 in Brooklyn, New York, Maynard was the son of immigrants from Barbados. Interested in writing at an early age, he frequently cut class at Boys High School to hang out at the editorial office of a black weekly newspaper, the New York Age. In 1967, Maynard was hired by the Washington Post as national correspondent, the first African-American to hold that position on any major newspaper. In 1977, he left the Washington Post and moved to the University of California, Berkeley, to found the Institute for Journalism Education. In 1979, he was hired by Gannett as editor in the newly acquired Oakland Tribune newspaper. When he purchased the Oakland Tribune in 1983, he became the first African-American in this country to own a major daily newspaper. In 1985, Maynard was the recipient of the Whit Carter Reddick Award from the College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin.
Langston had just put on a play called Simple Sings the Blues. And Jimmy Baldwin was just about to publish Notes of a Native Son. This was a period in Afro-American history that I was privileged to be the witness to, which was the moral preparation for the civil rights movement. That's what was going on in the middle to late 50s when I was traveling among this group of writers. They were raising the moral questions that would set the stage for Martin Luther King, for Malcolm X, and for the whole struggle that then ensued. The history of the movement up to that time is important to keep in context. Let me just go back 100 years. At the end of the Civil War, there was an attempt to bring blacks into some sort of economic participation and political participation in the South through Reconstruction, as it was called. Reconstruction collapsed in about the 1880s, and little by little, black people slipped into a status of semi-servitude. Yes, no longer slaves, but no, not quite free. And in that context came along a Supreme Court ruling called Plessy versus Ferguson, which decreed that as long as the state provided equal facilities for blacks, they could be separate. And that doctrine, separate but equal, is what prevailed from 1896 to 1954. Now, separate but equal was just a code word for segregation of the rankest sort. There was nothing the least bit equal about the treatment of blacks and whites in the South at that time. During World War II, black Americans went off, as you know, and distinguished themselves in war and died fighting for the freedom of this country. It was the people who came home in 1945, having fought and bled and seen their buddies die for democracy and freedom elsewhere, who began to plot the course for the overthrow of Plessy. They were lawyers primarily, you know, people who went to law school and set up shop at Howard University and used that as the launching pad for this assault on the second-class status of blacks in America. And as that battle began to heat up in the middle 50s, young writers and established writers began to try to define the black experience for public understanding so that white people could understand better. This was the period when Jimmy Baldwin wrote so eloquently about the status of blacks in the minds of whites. He said, you know, a nigger is not a person. A nigger is an idea. Why do you need a nigger? You know, what is it in your life that makes you need to see somebody else as being inferior? And he kept probing that question. And of course, you know, Langston was going at it from another side with the stiletto of satire. And other writers were grappling with it in different ways. And of course, the writers and the clergy and the activists of various kinds all finally began to sing off of one song sheet, as it were. into the middle of the 1950s. And so the Supreme Court, clearly hearing that the moral outcry had reached a level where this could no longer be tolerated, finally declared segregation legally void and replaced the evil doctrine of Plessy against Ferguson with the new doctrine of Brown against Board of Education. And from that moment, there grew the movement that eventually led to Dr. King and others marching on Selma and from Selma to Montgomery. And that ended, finally, the period of legalized separation of the races in this country. What it did not do is liberate our minds. It liberated our bodies. We became, at least physically, able to move about freely in American society. But the presupposition remained that we were intellectually still suffering from the legacy of slavery. We were still, our minds were still enslaved. And so the struggle since the mid-60s has been more of an intellectual struggle. It has been a struggle to establish our right to be viewed as equal in jobs that had previously been regarded as strictly, quote, white jobs. Newspaper editors, judges, physicians, you know, the whole range of places that we had been denied access in large numbers. Well, as we begin to fan out, as it were, from that from the enclosure of segregation into the broad society, we discover that we're not all exactly the same in the way we view the world, that to be successful in the world, we have to learn a variety of skills because there are all sorts of new challenges now that we should be working toward. And so I see my becoming an editor and owner of a major daily newspaper as being on the cutting edge of the opening up of this new arena of possibilities for the mind, which I think is every bit as important as what the previous era did to free our bodies.
You went to work for the Afro-American in Baltimore, and I assume that established you at a major American newspaper. Were you comfortable in coming to the Post after working at the Afro-American in Baltimore?
Well, I didn't go straight from the Post. Okay. I went first to a newspaper in Pennsylvania,
okay,
a daily newspaper, the York Gazette.
Okay.
And I worked there for 6 years. Then I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. Then, as you say, I met Ben Bradley while I was at Harvard as the Nieman Fellow. And he invited me to come and see him at the Post, and I did. And I had no discomfort, about coming there. I felt very good about it. It was a fabulous experience for me.
You said you learned a particular lesson, and I guess the illustration that they used in one of the particular articles, I think it was in Players Magazine, that you had written a person that had red paint thrown on his automobile, mm-hmm. and you somewhat was going to make a satire out of that experience, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the editor came to you, and well, it didn't come to you. He had whacked your particular story, mm-hmm. and you came to him and asked him why did he do this particular.
Yeah.
Could you expound on that more as far as making an impression on you as a journalist? And
well, let me start. Yeah, sure. Let me tell the whole story so that everybody will know what we're talking about. In my first day as a police reporter on the York Gazette, I went out to cover, to do what they call collecting the police blotter, where you go down to the police headquarters and you take down all these various complaints and so forth, and you write one paragraph stories about fender benders and so on. It's part of your early training. And I saw one complaint that said that John Smith had complained to the police that he had just that Saturday afternoon bought a brand new blue Pontiac convertible, and he parked it outside of his house over.
But in fact, this is a class society, and you could start a history of the United States with that sentence, the history of the United States is a history of class struggle. And it would be absolutely accurate. But can you imagine somebody writing, let's say, a textbook on American history for are very vulnerable students and starting off talking about our history being a history of class struggle. Can you imagine any major publisher publishing a book like that with that first sentence? Would it take very long for the publisher to go through that manuscript before rejecting it? And yet, it is an absolutely true statement.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn on a people's history of the United States. Part two of a special two-part program. You want to read a real history book? Matt Damon asks Robin Williams in the movie Good Will Hunting. Read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That book will knock you on your ass. Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States has sold more than 2 million copies, and it keeps on selling. His close friend Noam Chomsky said, "The book changed the consciousness of a generation." Zinn's history from below was to foreground, as he said, the countless small actions of unknown people. It was a sharp departure from the traditional focus on great men, presidents, generals, leaders, etc. His unorthodox approach presented the past stripped of its myths and propaganda. Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He was born in Brooklyn in 1922. His parents, poor immigrants, were constantly moving to stay, as he once told me, one step ahead of the landlord. After high school, he went to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. After the war, he went to Columbia University on the GI Bill. He was an active figure in the civil rights movement. He was among the first to oppose U.S. aggression in Indochina. A principled opponent of imperialism and militarism, he was an advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience. He spoke and marched against the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Always ready to lend a hand, he believed in and practiced solidarity. Witty, erudite, generous, and loved by many the world over, Howard Zinn, friend and teacher, passed away in 2010. This archival program was recorded at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And now, Howard Zinn.
As you know, the Founding Fathers were not a multicultural group. No women, no Native Americans, no blacks, and virtually no poor people. There was a 55, 53 maybe, 53 and a half rich white men who, as Charles Beard put it rightly, despite all the criticism he took for saying this, reflected the interests of the propertied classes. A strong central government was set up to protect the interests of the slave owners and the interests of the merchants and the interests of the bondholders. A country that would be able to move westward and protect the people who moved westward, who expanded into Indian lands. A government that would be able to send an army out into the Indian lands and get rid of the Indians and clear the way for white people to take over that land. Next time you hear somebody say, "We mustn't have big government," this country was founded on the idea of big government. The slave owners needed big government, the manufacturers needed big government, the bondholders needed big government, the expanders needed big government. They all wanted desperately to have big government. And the rich and elite in this country have always wanted big government. Only recently, relatively recently in this century, have they worried about what big government may do. Because big government, for most of our history, has been big government on behalf of the wealthy interests. We've had a welfare state in this country for a very long time, but most of the welfare was given to powerful and rich corporations. It wasn't called welfare, you see. And the railroads in the 1850s got something like 20 million acres of land free from the states. During the Civil War, the railroads got something like 100 million acres of land free from the federal government. 100 million acres free? You try to get an acre of land. One, just tell the government you want just a little bit of land. 1 acre. They did it for the Union Pacific. They can do it for me. You know. This was welfare on an enormous scale. Subsidies to the merchant marine. Subsidies to the manufacturers by increasingly higher tariffs, which are, of course, subsidies to the manufacturers and higher prices for the consumer. In 1931, Charles Beard, that same rascal who wrote about an economic interpretation of the Constitution, wrote an article called 31, remember, the midst of the Depression. And there's an argument about should the government do anything to help the poor, should we leave it to private charities? He wrote an article called The Myth of Rugged Individualism, because all the people were saying, we mustn't help all these people who don't have jobs anymore and who can't feed their families. In this country, we have a tradition. People have always made it on their own. And what Beard was asking was, did Rockefeller really make it on his own? Did Vanderbilt, did Harriman, did they really make it on their own? Did Carnegie and the steel industry really, did they make it on their own? And he listed in this article all the subsidies and all the grants that had been given by the federal government to the great corporations. History of legislation in this country is a history of class legislation. Legislation is rarely talked about in class terms. It's talked about as if all the laws that are passed apply equally to everybody. Like they will say, taxes are raised, taxes are lowered. Do you want a tax hike or do you want taxes lowered? Well, it's kind of a meaningless question unless you ask, whose taxes? Taxes where? Taxes at what level? But the idea is to embrace us all in one great family, as if the measures that are passed by Congress apply equally to all of us, but of course they don't. We've had class legislation in this country ever since the very first Congress, ever since Hamilton's economic program was passed by the very first Congress in